Back together again, you and I chatting it up on a Friday, wrapping up a busy week, December 12th, 2025, right here on Connecticut Today. I offered my thoughts starting the show on the next mandatory increase in Connecticut's minimum wage. It's going to $16.94 an hour. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso joined us with his weekly update, including his thoughts on the latest guilty verdict and the ongoing Bridgeport absentee ballot investigation. While CBS News White House reporter Willie James Inman dropped by, he had an update regarding the U.S. seizing a Venezuelan oil tanker and what might be coming up next between both nations. So I think it was around the middle of 1977. I had just turned 16. I was 16 in a couple of months. In, I think, June, July, or August of 1977. And somebody who lived a few doors down from us on our street had asked my parents if I was old enough to work and did I have a job at the time. And now obviously I didn't do any formal jobs during the school year. And those days I helped out my dad and my uncle in the family store. You know, it wasn't really on the payroll. Oh my God, I got paid. Didn't really get paid off the books, but I got paid off the books. And it was like one day a week and they would throw me like 10 bucks for the day. Now, 10 bucks in 1977, when you're 14 or 15 years old, it's a nice little stash there, but I digress. So the first time I was ever paid on the books and had to fill out the paperwork and saw money come back to me, not via check, but actually a little manila money envelope. Remember those, right? You'd fold up the money, and then on the front there would be your gross and your federal taxes and your Social Security taxes. Well, the first time that happened with me was, like I said, around mid or a little past mid-1977 for about a month or so in a special project that a business owner had who lived on my street, or a woman who lived on my street who worked for a business said, hey, does Paul want to work? So that was kind of like the first time I was ever on the books, per se, right? And, you know, rite of passage, hey, okay, you got to go down. We'll drop you off there. You'll work till 3, 4 o'clock, and Dad will come pick you up, whatever. Even though I had my license, we were a one-car family and all that and the such. And I remember that and we all kind of remember this, don't we? What the minimum wage was when we first started. Because we like to compare it to today, although to try and do that without a minimum wage calculator or something online that can add in the buying power and everything, sometimes it's futile. So you have to go to a actual website or put it into Grok or Google or whatever, or to some AI thing, and they'll figure it out for you. So my first stab at a 40-hour week ended up being $2.65 an hour. $2.65 an hour, which meant that I grossed about 94, 95, 96 bucks, whatever it was. It didn't break 100, because what? 265 times 40 is not going to break 100. So I was wondering what that was in today's dollars, because I don't want to come on here and say, well, geez, The minimum wage is going up again here in Connecticut. We're killing these businesses. You know, almost 17 bucks an hour. I made $2.65 an hour when I started. So I said, wait a minute. If that was today, how do I measure that versus today? And it's a little bit closer than I thought. So whatever AI generator picked this up when I simply typed in $2.65 and 1977's worth today, I get between roughly, I get about, at the most, it varies by about 10 or 20 cents, depending upon which source I'm looking at, I get about $13.40 an hour. So if I was starting out today, if back then I only knew what I know today. No, but seriously, if I was, you know, 16-year-old me today and not back in 1977, that 265, the absolute state of Connecticut minimum back then, would be equivalent to about $13 on the high end. Like I said, it varies a few cents here and there. $13.40 an hour. Right? So, again, just to go through this, so I was making $265 an hour back in 1977. So if you do that times 40 hours a week, it's $106 a week. Did I do that right? Yeah, I think I did. Let me make sure I did that right. Because even though I'm using the calculator on the computer, sometimes even clicking stuff makes me a dummy. Yeah, $106 a week. Now, that's chicken feed today. Now, if we did that, if I did that in, you know, today's realm, which is $13.40 an hour, then that would flip to $536 a week. You know where I'm going with this. Now, having said that, and I always like to bring this up toward the end of the year, because I think it is something that needs to be discussed in the realm of the constant talk and constant chatter we have now about what's the big word now? What's the big buzzword now? Affordability. Now, affordability plays on one side of the minimum wage argument, and it plays on the other side of the minimum wage argument. Because again, because Zohran Mamdani got elected, he is now the mayor-elect of New York City, everybody says, well, affordability this, and that's the key for 2026, and that's the key for 2028. Affordability. You know, everybody's talking affordability. One day the president loves it, the next day he doesn't love it. I don't know, I'm confused. I think it's vastly overstated. I think when you try and talk about affordability, you're basically, it's another word for the market forces. But having said that, Connecticut's minimum wage is about to go up again because of a law that, you know, has been put in by majority Democrats a few years ago. So it's going to go up to almost $17 an hour. Now, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing if you are a minimum wage employee or earner? Or is that a bad thing if you're trying to run a business, make a little bit of a profit, not exist as a nonprofit, not exist as a charity that gives everything back? So we will talk about that, but I wanted to start with this. And again, of course, you know where we start. It's our Facebook page, facebook.com/voiceofct. The People's Republic of Connecticut, the real DPRC, I'm kidding, will soon have the second highest minimum wage in the U.S. That minimum, going up on January 1, is now just a few pennies under $17 an hour, $16.94. Is that good or bad for state businesses? Why or why not? You tell me. We'll get into it. And this other question, too, I have. Should there even be a minimum wage? Now, you may say, well, that's crazy to think that. No, no, no. We'll explain that and more coming up straight ahead. Minimum wage going up in Connecticut to $16.94. Good, bad, or otherwise. We begin with that right here on WICC. Now, as we turn the calendar in a few weeks from 2025 all the way to 2026 already, Connecticut's minimum wage is going to go up to $16.94. Now, you may say, man, that's a lot of money. Well, you know, we pay a lot of money in this state. The minimum wage, we talked about this last year, because I like to bring this up every year when this flips, because I think it's worth discussing. It currently is $16.35 an hour. Now, it's going up to $16.94 an hour for 2026. Now, I don't know what the percentage is of people working full-time at minimum wage, but I guess the idea of doing this is that if you're a single person and you're only making minimum wage and you may not have any extraneous expenses, it's possible, despite the fact that a lot of us are spendoramas here, but you could have a single person, right? who is not married with no dependents, maybe doesn't carry a ton of credit card debt, maybe is, you know, driving a car that they bought and paid for in high school or whatever. And the best they can get is a minimum wage job, a couple of ticks under $17 an hour. So that would be roughly $677 a week. So that would be $35,000 a year. $35,200 under the new $1,694. $35,235. Now, versus when I started, which is a little less of an equivalent than $16.94. So if I was working full-time for minimum wage back in 1977, yes, I'm an old guy, I would have made $106 a week, which I did for a couple of months, and, you know, grossed about $5,500 a year. Now, again, these are before taxes. So, again, even that single person, like I said, who was grossing $35,000 a year, it would be tough unless they found a room to rent and whatever. Here's my point, though. When you take a look at the minimum wage, is Connecticut having the second highest, the fact that we have the second highest minimum wage in the country, next to, I think, California is number one. The fact that we have the second highest minimum wage in the country, is that good or bad? Now, you may say, well, of course, it's good for the employee. Why wouldn't we want the second highest or the highest or whatever? I got to double check on that. But why wouldn't you want that? All right, I get that. I understand that. But does the amount of Connecticut's minimum wage here, figure it roughly $17 an hour? $16.94, whatever. Roughly $17 an hour. Does that hurt businesses? Now, I'm sure we'll hear all of the familiar arguments. And frankly, I hear these every year, and I still think about it. I know they say, well, you know, the minimum should be high enough because if that's the only thing somebody can get, they should be able to live on it. Okay. But then what does that do? Two things. What does that do to the consumer who, listen, is going to end up paying for it? There's no free lunch. There's no free breakfast. There's no free dinner. And even though, you know, adjusted, like I said, looking back at what I was working at, or four, at minimum, it would have still been double digits today, but it would have been about $13.50 an hour versus $17 an hour. And then there's the whole concept, really, of having a minimum wage. You know, there are some economists, some people who make a study of this, saying, hey, why do we even have a minimum wage? If there was no minimum wage, wouldn't businesses have to battle each other for a little bit more? In other words, you have two shops together, and maybe one shop or one restaurant or one fast food place pays its people, or one big box retailer, they say, hey, we pay $23 an hour. And the competition says, well, you know what, I can't pay that, but I can pay the minimum. And there's no real impetus or ability for the competitor to that big box retailer or the fast food place or even the nicer restaurant to pay as much, if not more. So you tell me, our Facebook question of the day, we're already getting answers to it as usual. Folks, jump on this stuff early. Facebook.com/voiceofct. Connecticut will soon have the second highest minimum wage in the U.S. It's going up pretty soon to $16.94 an hour. Roughly, all right, knock it up 6 cents to $17 an hour. Is that good or bad for state businesses and individuals? Why or why not? Is $17 an hour, do you consider that too much? Is it too much for some things? Like, with all due respect, slinging coffee and burgers? Maybe you're a barista. Maybe you work at a fast food place. And you may say, well, that's ridiculous. That's way too much. Or do you say, hey, wait a minute, though. At least people can have a floor of a full-time wage, and maybe they like what they're doing, but the place they're doing it at, implying their trade at, can't pay them anymore. So what do you think? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, as we talk about the minimum wage. Yeah, the voice we welcome in every Thursday or Friday around this time, former Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso on All Things Bridgeport. Chris, as usual, good afternoon. Hope you're well. And no shortage of stuff once again, Chris, to talk about.
That's for sure, Paul. There's a plethora of things we could speak about.
Let's start with, again, albeit a low-level operative, Chris, we now have a second and third guilty verdicts here in this ongoing absentee ballot investigation going back to 2019 and 2023.
And I think it was interesting. She got 3 years suspended and 3 years probation. And I kind of believe, I could be wrong, but the prosecutors are probably trying to line up evidence against some of the more serious offenders, you know?
Yeah, and I guess, right, because you've always said the prosecutors say, okay, well, who told you X, Y, and Z, or, right, who did you report to on this?
Yeah, they may be looking for, frankly, a bigger fish in the pond. And the way you get to them is by those who commit the offense, but they're not as serious as some of the others.
Yeah.
And you have some wiggle room to get that person to turn on the big fish.
Yeah.
And that's what may be happening here. You know?
And Chris, the disappointing thing, and look, all the major, just about every major candidate has been involved in this in the last two cycles. But I kind of have to sit here and both laugh and cry when, Chris, we hear all the time, well, they know that they're not supposed to do this, or they well, do they? Because apparently it keeps happening.
You know, I've been in campaign headquarters most of my adult life with campaigns, and messages get back to people. You know, it's the wink, it's the nod, it's the unspoken word, and I think people know what they're doing. You know, some of these campaigns are hiring people as consultants, which is unheard of. What are they consulting on a campaign other than the fact that they have the ability to go door to door and, you know, get absentee ballots and defraud the public? So, you know, I think it runs deeper, and that's what maybe the prosecutors are looking at. You know, they also want to go into these trials as strong as they possibly can.
Yeah.
So they have all the evidence lined up, and that way they're able to strike a lot differently if they didn't try to line people up. You know, I think one of the most intimidating things, Paul, is when they turn the hot light on you, you know, and it could be the FBI, it could be the state investigators and so forth. They put the lights on and they tell you, listen, you're looking at 3 years in jail.
Yeah.
And here's a person who's older, right? And she says, well, I don't want to do jail time, right? Okay, well, then, you know, tell us what went on. Tell us, give us all the information. And that's, I think, where we see this thing turning. Because if you notice, the bigger offenders, the ones that, you know, have had many charges indicted, they're not getting plea bargains. They're not getting deals right now. So I think it's, again, circle the wagons, get the most evidence you can, and really hit hard some of these people that have just been abusive. You know, you have one individual who just constantly breaks the law and doesn't care. And I think the court has to set an example with that person. And, you know, we see it in the legislature. You know, this lack of activity when it comes to, you know, making the absentee ballot laws much stronger, right?
Yeah.
And because, you know what it is, Paul? If you clean up Bridgeport's abuse, then what happens to the rest of the towns? Because there's abuse going in other cities and other towns. It's just as exclusive to the cities. So if they clean up Bridgeport, guess what? Then issues are going to come up in their town. So they shy away from it.
Chris, a story that I was reading that I sent to you that's making the rounds now, when we turn the calendar year to 2026, there's going to, I guess, be some legislative action here regarding that question that was approved by 56% of the voters, which would be, as a lot of other states have it, you know, we have our six reasons to have an absentee. That would be no excuse absentee ballot. That would essentially be mail-in voting. And Chris, I have said numerous times, I'm okay for that with that. I see that coming. But the states that do it, Chris, they take years and years to develop a process with public input here. And I don't know whether you heard me my last couple of segments. When I start seeing the words, whether it's from Matt Blumenthal or any other legislator, well, we don't want to disenfranchise people. I mean, come on. I mean, come on. Please, stop.
They don't want to disenfranchise the people who are stealing elections.
Yeah, like... I mean, are we headed for a merry-go-round on this? I mean, my God. Yeah,
but this has been bantered about in the legislature for years. It was very much like same-day registration to vote on the same day.
Yeah.
You could register. And that went on for years and years, Paul. I remember bringing the bill out of the committee because I thought it was a good bill. And boy, it got stymied with, well, what did they do in Wisconsin? What did they do in Iowa? What's happening down in Kentucky? And the truth is that there were no violations of law that you could connect with that.
Yeah.
However, with this no excuse absentee ballot, it's fraught with violations of law. You know, you can go door to door with these things, give them to people, right? Help them fill it out. And there's no excuse. So I think, you know, there's got to be safeguards in place before this actually becomes law. I think the voters said, yeah, let's do it. It's much more convenient. It's easier to vote, especially with a busy work day and schedule. Mm-hmm. However, I don't think the voters said, hey, let's open the door and let all the thieves come in.
Yeah,
no, I'm sure they're looking for safety of the ballot, and that's critically important. I think that's the thing we have to watch now. But now it seems like because they didn't address the absentee ballot abuse and the violation of law, now let's come up with a new shiny object, and that happens to be mail-in voting.
Hey, because Chris, so, what could happen? Chris, come on,
Paul? Yeah, come on. You know, nothing could happen, Paul.
And finally, speaking of what could happen, Chris, I know you have a unique perspective on this. The Bridgeport City Council—they still don't have a leader. And apparently, there were accusations among two council members that, somebody got a little over-enthusiastic and with it. Then now apparently the prosecutor said there was nothing there. Okay. I had to explain a few things to my listeners the other day. But as
only in Bridgeport, Paul, could that happen. It's really, it's amazing, isn't it? It's just, wow.
So who's going to be the head of the council once this all the dust clears here, Chris?
Well, I think right now it's still, you know, one candidate has 10 votes, but I don't think she has 11 to get elected. The other one has 8. And I think after a couple of ballots, maybe 2-3 ballots, I think you'll see some peeling off from the candidate that has the most votes. And then those votes will line up with another candidate. And I think that's what's going to happen. Right now, I think everyone is keeping their powder dry, if you will.
Yeah.
And they're all just keeping things close to their vest, and they're going to stand with their candidate. But after the second or third ballot, if things don't start moving, then I think you'll see some peeling off of people that supported one candidate, and they'll shift to another. And in that case, it's probably Akeem Boyd would probably withstand the best chance at that point. You know, the person who has the 10, because I've been in that situation, I had 10 one time when I ran for council president. And let me tell you, it's like herding cats.
Yeah.
It's the hardest group of people to keep together and stay focused.
Wow.
And then as the ballots keep going around, people start getting antsy and say, well, you know, we cast a vote for you, but now there's an opportunity to make a deal with someone else. So I think if you get 2-3 ballots, I think things start to change. And it usually favors the person with the least votes.
Interesting.
And that's what, you know, my history has shown that. Because, you know, people, you know, the attention span of people isn't the longest, Paul. And not all people.
After a while, right? After a while.
Yeah.
It's enough.
You know, they want to go. I remember I was debating one night at the council about a parking lot deal with the developer. And it was a sweetheart deal.
Yeah.
And I'm going there holding, and the guy sitting next to me says, one of my colleagues, says, I want to go home and see the Yankees game. And so we should just
the hell with it.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, Chris, great stuff. Chris Caruso, thanks, man. Have a happy weekend, Chris. We'll talk.
You too,
all right, bye-bye. Yeah, who wants to debate this parking lot stuff and revenue when the Yankees are on? This whole, I find this fascinating, this whole Venezuela thing with the seized tanker and the U.S. Marines and the Navy commandeering this tanker a few days ago. Still not maybe getting a straight story on this. Let's go to one of our go-to people in D.C. that may help us out on this. CBS News Washington reporter Willie James Inman joins us. Willie, good afternoon. Willie, can you make this make any sense? Is the White House still being kind of circumspect here as to what the goal is here for Venezuela or not? What are they telling you, folks?
Hey, well, the president really hasn't laid out a clearly defined goal, and public polling will support that because Americans believe that the president really hasn't laid out what the priority is in terms of what he wants to do in Venezuela. And when we've asked, or I'm talking about other reporters, when he's been pressed about details as to if he wants regime change or if land strikes will indeed happen, the president often demurs. Now, this seizure of the oil tanker that happened just days ago is quite different from the drug interdiction program with the strikes on alleged drug boats. That is, those are two different things.
Yeah.
But the White House is defending the seizure, essentially saying that this was a sanctioned vessel that was participating in black market sales of oil to sanctioned parties, in this case, the Iranian regime. So clearly, the White House wants to put pressure on Nicolas Maduro, the leader of Venezuela, and put pressure in large part by hitting him where it hurts in terms of taking that oil off the marketplace for Maduro to be able to profit from it.
And Willie, so maybe from what you can understand there and the other folks in the Daily Press Corps, they may be just kind of releasing this info, maybe in drips and drops out there to not really show their entire hand here. You think that's a possibility here?
Well, two things are clear. One is the White House wants to put pressure on Maduro, in large part because the president and other U.S. officials believe that he's essentially behind the killing of Americans for illicit drug sales and those drugs that make it to our shores. And the other part of this is the thing that we can see, the buildup of military forces in the Caribbean, the operation that we saw, and that information was released to us publicly. So we can see all of those things. But lawmakers, reporters included, certainly have questions in terms of what is the intent here. There's some concern on Capitol Hill that the president is slow walking the U.S. into a war, into an armed conflict with Venezuela. Now, the president hasn't ruled out land strikes on those alleged drug cartels or whatever they are in Venezuela. But there's certainly a lot of questions about the intent of these actions in Venezuela and against Venezuela with that seizure of this vessel included, but really not a lot of clear answers necessarily coming from this White House.
CBS News reporter Willie James Inman. Willie, thank you. We appreciate it. Thanks for the time and have a safe weekend. We appreciate it, sir. Thank you.
All right. You too. Thank you.
All right. There you go. Willie James Inman.